or someone you love wish you had a better job? Want to be happier on your current job? Don't even have a job? Welcome to Work with Marty Nemko.
Over the years, a number of the callers to the show have expressed interest in things organic, things sustainable, and so on. So I thought it was time to do a show on what it's really like to be an organic farmer. So I headed over to the Temescal Farmers Market near where I live, and I asked people who are selling organic produce, who's the person I should have on my show? And, you know, usually you would think there'd be no unanimity, but there really was unanimity. I spoke to four or five people, and they all said the same person, Josh Thomas, of Thomas Farm down near Santa Cruz, Coralitos, to be precise. So, Josh Thomas, welcome to Work with Marty Nemko.
All right.
All right. Now, your father was in the business, right? Did you always know you were going to take over for him?
Absolutely not. Until my early 30s, I really didn't want to have much of a part of farming. It looked like a lot of work. I mean, a tremendous amount of work and not a tremendous amount of money. But my dad came to me and he said he was going to retire and that the legacy would die, to be dramatic. And I gave it some good thinking. I mean, I was working on the farm. I was doing farmers markets. And I said, well, you know what? I'm gonna give this a try. I'm going to try farming.
And what surprised you? Was there anything, you know, you'd grown up on it, you'd seen it, but was it different? Was there anything that surprised you once you got into it that you didn't realize not owning it?
Yeah, I would say it was much more rewarding, and that sounds cheesy, and it is kind of cheesy, but it was much more rewarding than I thought it would be to, you know, grow things and take it to the market and sell things and just do the whole circle. And much like I thought, it is a tremendous amount of work.
Yeah, I believe it. So why don't you do my picture in my mind, because I'm not a farmer at all, is that you've got these, you know, I don't know, 40 acres and a modern-day version of a plow, and that you've got a bunch of people, including undocumented immigrants, illegal immigrants, whatever you want to call them, working for you, planting, picking, doing that stuff. And then because it's organic, there's no spraying or any of that, and then you just put it in boxes and then clean it and then take them to the various distribution places. What's in what way is that accurate and not accurate?
Well, the acreage is pretty accurate. I believe you said 40 acres, and we're currently at 46. We sell almost everything at farmers markets. And so the business is kind of like two businesses. It's you grow the things, so you have a crew that helps you grow the things, harvest the things, weed the things. And then you have a whole separate crew that helps you sell the things. And they're your marketeers driving box trucks off to different towns. Flower-slinging carnies is what one marketeer calls himself. They set up tents and sell flowers. So it's one business with two distinct parts.
Okay. So you say you work long days. Walk me through your day. What time you get up in the morning? I mean, I always think of farmers getting up in the morning, like at 4 in the morning, whatever. What time you get up?
I tend to kind of wake up and try not to wake up to an alarm clock because I try to give the body what it needs as far as sleep. But typically that is, you know, somewhere in the neighborhood of 7 o'clock, 6:30 to 7:30. So not
crazy hour.
Crazy early. Right. But I go late. Okay. I go past when everyone else goes. So I'll, you know, we do 6 farmers markets on Saturday, 6 farmers markets on Sunday. We're at 6 farmers markets today. So the day before, loading all those trucks.
Mm-hmm. Do you do that? Maybe the owner of the farm. Are you there loading up the trucks with boxes?
Well, I have a loading crew.
Yeah.
So I do plenty of the lifting myself, but loading 6 trucks day in, day out, you know, it just wears you out.
Of course, of course.
But you got to keep an eye because they go over Highway 17 from Santa Cruz County to the Bay Area. There's a lot of twists and turns. You got to make sure the load is secure.
Right.
You're not going to dump your bucket of dahlias onto your other bucket of dahlias. So
with your tomatoes, which you mainly go, I could just see this, you know, this tomato juice on Highway 17. It wouldn't be too good.
Yeah, Yeah, I would. That's one of the things we do is we have a note to make sure the marketeers close the back door of the box truck, because we have done exactly what you're talking about. Left, hit a bump, and some of the produce just kicks out the side.
Right. Well, walk me through your day. So you start at 7:30 as you get up. So walk me through your day, especially focusing on the things that maybe might surprise our listeners.
Well, early in the morning, with a cup of coffee, I'll do a little research on what we're going to be planting, what we're going to be growing in the future. A lot of this is planning out, because each crop takes, you know, the fastest crop you got is potatoes, maybe at 60 days, 70 days from planting that to harvesting it. Everything else, sunflowers are within that parameter too, but everything else takes a lot longer to plan. Everything
really?
Is thinking in the future.
I mean, I grow my early girl tomatoes in my backyard, and it's like they say it's 53 days, you know.
Do you get that 53 days?
No, that's a lie. But, I mean, it's not like 90. how long does it take to... I mean, I actually bought your tomatoes at your Temescal place here. Early girl tomatoes, which you call dry farm, because they were only... You told me they were off the air, that they were only watered once a year. Boy, is the flavor concentrated. They're delicious. How long does it really take from early girl seed to when you're putting them in a box?
All right, so the seed, we actually don't do the starting of our early girls ourselves. Okay. We actually have a contract grower who does that.
Oh.
So basically, I get a bag of seeds untreated because it's an organic operation. A lot of seeds are treated with a fungicide so they won't rot.
Fyram.
Ours are all untreated seeds. That's... We deliver that to the contract grower, and he puts those into cells, 396 trays, cells in a tray.
Right.
So that's 396 plants in a tray. And so an acre of early girls is somewhere around 10,000 plants, because we plant them a foot apart. And so he grows those for us. So I might give him the seeds, I don't know, early February, and he'll have them ready for me after risk of frost. Because you don't want to transplant all those out and then have a real cold day come and kill them all.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, he grows them out. Somewhere in March, he'll phone me up and say, they're ready, pick them up. So we'll put them in maybe late March and won't get fruit until August.
So it is more like 6 months. And I'm sure you start them as little plugs, little one inch long by half inch wide little plugs, just barely.
More or less, yeah. It's kind of funny seeing the plant is so big and the amount of soil is so small mm-hmm. when he gives them to us.
Okay, so now continue to walk me through your day. What's the rest of your day look like, typically?
So I get to work, and up until last year, we were 11 acres, and we've moved recently to 46 acres total. So we more or less have quadrupled the size of the business.
So, why? Is that scary?
It is. you know, the lease itself on the new acreage we got is going to be $45,000 a year just for the 30 acres, $1,500 an acre a year.
Yeah.
So, I mean, just that one thing. And then the labor, we've gone from just a couple guys. Now we have a crew of like 10 harvesting, another crew of 12 to 14 marketeers. So you're looking at a business that employs like between 20 and 30 people year round. So there's a decent amount of payroll right there. So my job is actually, I used to be more hands-on, but now I'm actually a little bit more of a finger pointer as much as I can be, and just hit it hard, work hard, sweat when I have to.
What are the kind of things you've got to finger point about? They know what they're supposed to do. What in the real world, what do you end up having? What are the things you have to say, the finger pointing you've got to actually do?
We're an extremely diverse farm, and so some things have different water needs, for instance. And that's just from experience, to know that this kind of cut flower, a dahlia, needs more water than maybe the sunflowers do. But just keeping an eye on the irrigation, because in California it doesn't rain from sometime in maybe April until we're starting to head into the rainy season now. Late October we normally don't get rain. So in California everything's about irrigation. So you have to keep an eye on the water needs of the plant.
What else do you have to finger point? Are there personnel issues? I mean, you know, this is the kind of job, it's not a high-wage thing, so you're not necessarily getting, you know, I would imagine. What are the workers like? No, I don't want to guess. You have 10 people on your crew. How often do they turn over? What kind of problems do you have? What are the good things? How would you, no BS, how would you really describe your workers and what it's really like managing them?
I think the people who do the harvesting, the people who do the actual, quote, farm work, the weeding, planting, all that, they come to us and they stick around. Just they've found what they want to do. And we've had a guy since 1990.
What do they make?
We start farm work at $10 an hour. Basically, it can move up to 12. Once you learn to drive a tractor and you start adding skills on top of that, take on responsibility, irrigation, the more technical aspects, we're looking at 13 to 14. The foreman is making 14, is going to move to 15.
Okay, and let's say Cesar Chavez came back to life and he showed up on your farm. What would he be saying to you?
I think we get good retention because we run a pretty fair operation. We pay every Friday. There's never some Friday where I come to the guys and say, oh, next week it's going to happen. Every Friday we get payroll together and we're able to pay. We do the breaks. We pay for every hour.
Breaks
work.
Mean like, you mean 10 minutes of break every
yep.
hour?
Kind every,
of
mm-hmm. every 10 minutes. Everyone's legal. You know, there's cool drinking water. There's available at any time. Basically following all the rules.
You know, I've been noticing, I'm going from thing to thing. We'll get back to you today. But, you know, it seems like increasingly over the last couple of years, you hear about a listeria outbreak or a salmonella outbreak in the lettuce or the, you know, the cucumbers or whatever. Why do you think is it increasing and why do you think that's occurring?
That's a good question. That's what keeps me up at night is cleanliness. I mean, it's a marathon of work to keep everything clean.
We know there's dirt, but what goes on? Where are the problem points? Where can things go wrong?
I think on these operations are so different than ours, it would just be a guess of what. I think it's fairly rare that a smaller farm has as much trouble as people who grow just massive amounts of things, and that something just goes wrong somewhere along the line, and there's no one there to catch it. You know what I mean?
Is it like this is just ignorance? But I'm picturing that, like, you know, in these big fields, there's all kinds of animals that go around and they pee and poop all over. Or sometimes, you know, if some guy is working out in the field and he's got to go, he's not going to go the 300 yards to the porta potty. He's going to say, "Oh, what the heck?" Is that a likely cause of the problem?
That could well be. I believe spinach. They traced the spinach outbreak a couple of years ago to wild boar coming mm-hmm. into the field, mm-hmm. and just there wasn't someone there to make the call. Oh, this has been, you know, defecated on. This shouldn't move into the rest of it. It was just moving along at the pace of that they move along. No one was there to put a stop to it.
Truthfully, you know, the percentage of produce that's tainted is so small. Our farming is quite, I would think, is quite admirable in terms of their quality rating. You compare that to cars and how often they break down, how many often their lemons, pardon the pun, I think our produce is a heck of a lot more reliable. Do you think that's fair?
I do. It is kind of amazing. You know, I don't know if it's just that humans are pretty dang tough animals. But it is amazing more people don't get sick. There's so many things out there looking to get us sick, but.
Well, I'll tell you, having eaten those dry farmed, girly girl tomatoes from the farmer's market over at Temescal, I'm not going to get sick from those. You've got to wash it. I mean, clearly you got to wash your produce. Anyway, you're listening to Work with Marty Nemco. My guest is Josh Thomas. He is the dude who runs Thomas Farms. Farm, not farms, now up to 46 acres. And he sells it at 8 farmers markets. I'm not some crunchy guy by nature. I'm kind of this moderate Democrat guy, maybe even sometimes you have conservative views. But, you know, I got to tell you, there's nothing like a real organic, dry-grown tomato. If you haven't had one of those early girls, get your butt to a farmer's market while it's still in season. You got another couple of weeks if they're still in season?
No, we actually, our tomato crop wasn't. You know, the blight moved in this year, and we actually, we picked what we could from that. We had a couple acres of tomatoes this year, the most we'd ever grown. And the disease moved in and really decimated the crop. So the land has cost us so much to farm.
Wow.
We had to mow it and disc it.
That's what you always hear about farming. You always hear that farming, you know, for... I'm just listening to David McCulloch's biography of Harry Truman, who was a farmer, and John Adams, who was a farmer. And there is such risk with farming. And it's a really tough profession, no question. Let's forget about the rest of your day for now. What is the best and worst things, really, about being this organic farmer, the guy who owns Thomas Farm?
The best thing of owning Thomas Farm is owning Thomas Farm in that no one tells you what to do.
Yeah.
You're your own boss. That is by far the best thing.
Mm-hmm.
The worst thing is that it is relentlessly greedy on your time, on your energy, on your money. The farm does not feel guilty at all about taking every ounce of bone marrow from you and asking for more when you're done giving it.
Give some examples.
Think of growing plants is you're keeping all these things alive, you know, basically thousands and thousands of things alive. Like if you had a goldfish when you were a kid, you wake up in the morning and the thing's belly up. It's kind of like that, but there's just thousands of them out there. And you have to not only keep them alive, but make sure the quality's there. Because you have to sell this thing. It's not already sold.
Every one. I mean, when I'm going in there buying those organic, I'm looking at every tomato. I'm picking the one that looks the best, that's got the heaviest with juice, not a light one that's going to likely be mealy. You know, every single one. And each item costs nothing. You know, the organic tomatoes, they cost $2.50 a pound. So, you know, and the tomatoes are small because they're not pumped up with a bunch of stuff. So here, you know, you're having to create for something that's going to cost me retail pennies, and you've got to keep the quality control incredibly high. It's very difficult, I would think.
It is. It is.
Yeah. What else is a suck on your time or your money that might surprise our listeners, perhaps?
It's logistically, it's very challenging. Doing all these farmers markets, all these trucks, all the trucks need maintenance. You got to make sure everything's, you know, in good condition, or it won't make it to market. You break down on the side of the road, got to get it towed home. You don't get the receipts from that market. All the tractors need maintenance. All the people need a certain amount of maintenance. It's a lot of tasks to do each day.
So, you know, if I'm putting myself in the shoes of the listener who's, you know, who had romanticized the idea, you know, maybe I'm going to quit my corporate job selling and marketing or distributing widgets, and instead I'm going to become an organic farmer. Would you laugh at them, tell them, go run away, or is the market still not saturated? What would you honestly, if I'm your brother, and I'm working for the Bay Area Widget Corporation, and I'm a marketing manager, I'm making $80,000 a year with benefits, I'm working 50 hours a week, but I'm a kind of a Bay Area crunchy type, and I'm thinking organic farm is cool. What would you honestly tell me?
I would say there's the most important question you have to answer. Where are you going to sell it? Decide what you want to grow is where you're going to sell it.
All right, so let's role play this out. So let's say, okay, well, I'm going to try to get into the Safeways. I'm going to try, or the independent, like, gourmet supermarkets that are local, and try to convince them to buy my organic, I'll stay with this organic tomato thing because I'm just hot on those. You know, the early grow, the dry roast, I love that. Water them once a year, save the water, really concentrated flavors. Love that concept. So my gig is going to be to have one crop per season. Like in the summer, it's going to be these organic great tomatoes. And I'll try to get them into the local market, local supermarkets that are, you know, the independently owned ones. And if I can, maybe once I can prove that I can produce enough quantity, I may go to bigger ones and try to get them to do it. And also I'll do some farmers markets that are maybe just coming up. What would you say to me?
I would say there's a dozen people doing that exact same thing already who have a track record and tomatoes. I mean, for our local farmers markets, I'm on the board of directors, and we have a commodities. And basically, the commodities looks at the farmers market as a whole and makes sure everything is represented, but not too much.
Mm-hmm.
Because we want the people who grow those things to be able to make money.
Sure.
So you don't want 20 people growing tomatoes. You want to have 5 or 6 people growing tomatoes so they can make a living. So tomatoes, It's pretty saturated. It's pretty saturated.
What's
even
not
the dry farm?
So I'm your brother. Okay. And so I say, okay, all right, I'll give up the tomato thing. I just want to grow something. I want to get out of corporate America. I can't stand all of the BS, all the meetings. You got to have three signatures to blow your nose. I don't want any of that stuff. I want to go and run my own farm. And I'll sell anything, marijuana. I'll sell whatever it is. I want to grow my own and make a middle class living. Would you say, forget it, man, it's still delusional, it's all saturated? Or would you, what niche would you tell me to go into?
You know, I would say you're not delusional. You can definitely make a middle class living. We do, and it's a heck of a lot of work, but really you have to figure out, I mean, I'm not going to do that work for you. You're going to have to figure out what the market needs. Does it need hard cider? Should you buy an apple orchard and start making hard cider and get into that racket? Should you grow dry beans because you don't really need anybody to work for you? You can do that all with a machine, so you don't have that overhead. Should you grow rice? I don't know. Where do you live?
And of course, then there's standard market research, which is not so easy to do, and market research is notoriously invalid. There's a piece of me that thinks I would want to go for an expensive product like macadamia nuts, finding an area that isn't, that it's just, you know, we don't normally grow macadamia nuts here because the weather isn't quite good enough. I don't think it's quite hot enough. But I would try to find some little way in which I could do that, because then I'm getting a lot of money per. You're making a scrunchy face. Is that a face because you hate the idea or love the idea?
Oh, no. I mean, macadamia might be great. Yeah, I don't know how they would grow here. And then also, it's been my experience, especially with this tomato thing we just got through, is putting all your eggs in the one basket. Mm. I mean, that's a recipe for going out of business.
Monoculture is risky. Yeah. No question. Okay. Let's go off that. Now, is there anything else, by the way, in your day that is, as we've walked through at least part of your day, that might be interesting enough to take a little time for you to tell us about?
Well, it's, let's see. I mean, figuring out where the next thing is going to go is always interesting, because even though...
The next crop.
You know,
tell us
for instance, right now we're getting ready for our spring flowers right now.
Right.
We're going to put anemones. I'm soaking the anemones, which are these little...
It sounds like an enema. It's a very dangerous word. I don't actually like that. And also, don't anemones, they last like a day?
These anemones will actually last you close to 2 weeks.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Yeah, they're the Jerusalem anemone is the one we grow. They're actually the little corm, I believe is what they call them, but it's like a small bulb is grown in Israel. And we actually had a hard time getting pink anemones this year because they had a hailstorm that destroyed their crop of those. But anyways, we're soaking those. They'll plump up. We'll plant them next week. Ranunculus are another one we're getting ready to soak and plant, and the tulip shipments are going to be coming in at the end of this month. So we're just thinking about where that stuff's going to go, where it's going to be happy, logistically where it's going to be close to the packing shed, and so we can keep an eye on it.
Yeah. Okay. Well, are there any... products, any kind of products you've been maybe thinking about growing that is really would be a breakthrough, innovative, cool thing that's scary maybe, but is feels like it's tempting?
Yes, the organic tuberose.
Really white, fragrant things.
Extremely fragrant. Nothing smells like a tuberose.
Right.
And typically they like it warm, a little bit warmer than where we're at, but we're figuring out some tricks to try and get them to warm up a little bit. And no problem selling them. It's just getting, which is normally not the case in the business I'm in, is normally no problem growing it, some problem selling it.
For small, am I correct or incorrect that one of the ways you could warm things up is by putting a reflective material on the ground so that it reflects the heat up into the plant?
It'd be more, we're looking at using a black plastic mulch perhaps to cover the bed and actually warm up the ground, warm up that bulb so it blooms more often.
And what if I argued that that will warm the soil, but is it not correct in order to get satisfactory ripening that you really need to warm the leaves and the fruit, essentially the flowers?
We're going to try just warming the bulb first, and if that doesn't work, we may cover it with what they call a high tunnel, which is like a... very inexpensive way to greenhouse.
Right, right.
Greenhouse the crop.
Basically plastic with a, I'm guessing, a PVC kind of a circular thing.
It's a steel structure that would warm up and keep the nights warmer is a big thing.
Yeah.
Don't let them cool down quite so much at night.
Yeah.
It seems like in our business, it's moving more and more to having plastic everywhere, and I try and steer away from it as much as possible. We got the drip tape, it's plastic. We got the plastic mulch for covering beds, and now covering the land with plastic. You drive around Watsonville, where our, a lot of bushberries are grown, and it's just like a sea of plastic.
Right.
And strawberries.
Isn't there biodegradable stuff that's put together with, like, flour or something, these kind of plastics that much of it biodegrades?
As far as I know, it would biodegrade into your soil but wouldn't be organically allowable.
Got it. Okay, let's play a game. I'm going to say a word, and you tell me the first word that comes to mind, okay? Safeway.
I would say poor quality.
Okay. Trader Joe's.
I would say poor quality.
Farmers markets.
I would say a much higher quality.
Farming.
Farming, a lot of work that can be rewarding.
Organically grown.
It might not be perfect, but it definitely is better.
Government, in what way is it not perfect?
Basically, what organic is trying to set up rules to dictate a certain behavior. And whenever you do that, there's going to be people who try to just cut it as
sure.
finely and as closely to those rules as is possible.
Sure.
It's basically something that's kind of undefinable they're trying to define. So it's definitely a step in the right direction. It's definitely better than conventional.
So what's the gray area? What is that where one quote organic grower might choose to do X, but the organic farmer right next door might not do it? What's one of those gray areas?
Cover cropping. Basically, you're planting something. Right now, we're getting ready to cover crop. We just put some seed down yesterday. And basically, it's a mix. The cover crop we use is a mix of bell beans, vetch, peas, and oats. And what it does is that you don't harvest it. You're just putting it on the soil to prevent erosion. That's number one for us because our soils are highly erosive. Number two, it adds organic matter to that soil.
Because when it gets turned over into the soil, it decomposes and enriches.
Basically,
enriches
it's like the mucus of the soil that is holding it together.
Quite an image.
Yeah.
It's not soil.
And then also it can be a nitrogen fixer, so you don't have to buy your nitrogen.
Right, you can actually
plant something to provide nitrogen for the crop you're going to put
on. When does that cause any problems with being organic? You mean those seeds are not organically...
They are organic. The cover crop seed we do is organically. But some organic farmers don't cover crop because you're tying up the soil there and you're not getting a crop that you actually can sell.
So why does that violate organic principles?
Because the land, when it rains, that soil just drifts right downhill.
Oh, I see. But it's not really, it's still organic. It's just not conserving maximally the soil.
Exactly.
Or it's not like you're eating pesticides as a result of this.
Exactly, right.
Okay, so really I can see where that is not exactly critical. Okay, back to our little game. Again, what's the first word that comes to mind when I say the word government regulations?
Oh. Yeah, that would be the word. A lot of them.
Give me an example. What are some examples of government regulations that make you pull your hair out?
You know, we've had employees who have done things that are just, like, catastrophically bad, and we've let them go. And it still turns out that you even though we're very warranted, that they can get unemployment. And, I mean,
give me an example. I don't get it.
Almost sure intoxicated and driving a box truck to a farmer's market intoxicated.
Mm-hmm.
Extremely dangerous and risky. The vehicle's a big, heavy.
But that's not excessive. You said you kind of sighed and rolled your eyes when you said government regulations, a lot of them. That's clearly, you know, drunk driving. Nobody would argue with that. What's a government regulation that in reality has driven you crazy?
You know, most of them I try hard to understand and do find what they're trying to get at. You know, sometimes that's a little bit of a journey to figure out what they're trying to do. But for the most part, I agree with most of what they do, if not all. Maybe the way they do it, it might be a little overhanded, but so be it.
Okay, move off that. Okay, next, back to our game. What's the next first word that comes to mind when I say the word water?
Conserve. That would be the first word.
What's the first word when I talk about illegal or undocumented workers?
Geez, what would be the first word? Everyone we use is legal. So I guess the first word would be we don't go down that path.
Okay. Why?
It just, you could get in trouble for it. But really, I think that everybody should pay in. I mean, we're all in this kind of together. So everyone should pay into it. Everyone is over the books. No one's under the table. And pay the Social Security.
Okay. All right. Let's end with a softball question. If I am a consumer, let's say, you know, now we're not talking about the career, and we've talked a little bit about the career. But if I am interested in buying things organic, and I'm not an extremist, I'm not interested in whether the use a cover crop or not, but I'm interested in going to a farmer's market and buying good stuff. What would be the consumer advice you would give to me as to how to be a wise shopper in a farmer's market?
I would just take a look at the produce and see if it's fresh. You know, you can actually tell, even if you don't have an experience with harvesting your own backyard garden or what have you, you can actually tell if something is fresh or not just by the way it looks, like the shine it has. Zucchini, for instance, actually has a sheen on it, a shine, when it's fresh. As soon as it's even one day old, definitely by 2 days old, it's kind of a dull green color.
Keep going. What are some other, that's a great tip. What else?
Ask the people selling it a little bit about the stuff.
Like what? What's a good question? What would you ask if you were going up to a vendor? What would you ask them?
When was this harvested would be one I would do. How long would this last? Do you eat this yourself is a good one that no one thinks to ask the actual person who's selling you this stuff. Have you eaten this one? And if they have, ask them about that. Yeah. Ask how they cooked it and how it tasted.
It's a great question. Okay. And then finally, if people would like to, do you ever go to the organic, to the farmer's markets yourself or no?
I do go to the farmer's markets, but I work at them less and less. It's more like we swing by them.
So which farmer's markets do you sell your stuff? I know you sell at six. Tell us which they are and which is your personal favorite and why.
We sell it actually currently. I think we're at like 16 farmer's markets a week. Yeah, it's a lot.
So which are your favorites, your few that you think are really just wonderful farmers markets? It's a destination that's worth, it could be four or five, that are worth somebody making a little bit of a drive to get to because they're such good farmers markets.
The Ferry Plaza Farmers Market on Saturday is hard to beat. It has a little bit of everything. It's in a gorgeous location.
In San Francisco, right off the Embarcadero. Uh-huh.
Yep. Downtown Santa Cruz is a really fun farmers markets. You never know what you're going to see at the downtown Santa Cruz farmers market.
Uh-huh.
For a smaller one, you know, the West Side one in Santa Cruz, West Side Farmers Market.
How about the Bay Area? Because this show kind of peters out in terms of the signal at around Palo Alto to the south and northern Marin to the north and Lafayette, to the east. Where would you say in the general Bay Area, where would you say the farmers markets that are worth going to are? Particularly worth going to.
Like I said, the Ferry Plaza, Fort Mason, farmers market, which is today. The Grand Lake Farmers Market.
Oh, in Oakland.
Uh-huh. Yeah, in Oakland is just...
That's near the Grand Lake Theater? Is that where it is?
I believe so.
Okay.
It's been an absolute... We've recently started going to that one, and it's just a phenomenal farmers market for us.
Great.
We just sell flowers there, and we sell a lot of flowers there. It's basically become our best farmers market.
Oh, one more.
The Temescal Farmers Market, the one that...
That's where I go. I live two minutes from there.
Yeah. Yeah,
that's in North. It's right near the Claremont Avenue DMV. It's right there, and it's in their parking lot, as a matter of fact. All right, Josh Thomas, it's been a real pleasure having you on Work with Marty Nemco, and you can get his produce at farm. You know, some in addition to flowers, what else can you get from that's at your stand? At these farmers markets.
Right now, we still have potatoes, and we're have a lot of winter squash right now. And, of course, the cut flowers is a major part of our business. And summer squash right now is
still gorgeous dahlias, right?
Yep.
Gorgeous dahlias. Okay. Josh Thomas, thanks again for being my guest on Work with Marty Nemco.
All right. Thank you.
Great. All right. And now, as usual, we turn to you. My mission in life, or certainly on this show, is to try to help you for free get the kind of career help that I give to my clients during the week. That don't get it for free. And so if you or someone you love has got a career problem, don't know what you want to be when you grow up, like to be self-employed, you've had a real challenge at work, something that made you very angry this week, and don't know quite how to resolve it. I had something like that happen to me this week, which I can't share with you, but it's true. But would, you know, like to get some a fresh perspective. All you need to do is pick up the phone for what I call a 3-minute career makeover. The phone number, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. I particularly like the idea of if you have a business idea that, you know, that you're thinking of starting and are scared to pull the trigger, or at least would like a perspective on how to improve it or get my thumbs up or thumbs down on whether I'd invest in it, I think that is a particularly useful reason for you to call, because it is so hard to land a job these days. One of the few paths to self-employment, a few paths to a middle-class living, is a smart self-employment plan. So if you've got an idea for self-employment you want to run by me, I will be like a venture capitalist. I will both give you thumbs up or thumbs down and tell you what I think you need to do to improve it to make it even more likely to be successful. The phone number again here at Work with Marty Nemco for what I call a 3-minute career makeover, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. And right to the phones. Welcome to the show. It is your turn on the air. How can I help? Hello.
Is that me?
Yes.
Oh, hi. Hi, Marty.
Hi.
My name is Elise, and I've developed a program for the last 25 years that works teaching young children emotional literacy and how to get along, essentially.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm also a program director of a nonprofit in the afternoon. So what I'm looking to do is to freelance at least one of my jobs, and I'm wondering about the first steps to do that. I have worked with, like, coaching different families and their children, mm-hmm. you know, on the same issues that I work with in my ongoing job.
Mm-hmm.
And I've just actually got an offer to be a consultant working on the theme of bullying for a film that's going to be in South Africa.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, that's my first question. I know I have to be concise here. Thank you, Irene. I'm just starting out in terms of consulting. I do puppetry and the expressive arts, so I was specifically asked to coach on this film regarding puppetry. So I guess maybe it's an ethical question. Can I use my years of experience, even though this would be the first time that I'm consulting on a film, and use my normal prices, or how do I find out about the range of what's asked for it?
Well, a couple of thoughts. With regard to pricing, I have, frankly, very different pricing when I give a speech, depending upon how much money they have and how much more I want to do it. I'm inferring that you really want to do this. If they are well-funded, you know, then I would probably be asking a fairly high rate. I would probably, you know, make my rate something. I'm making this up, but given who you are, I would make my rate something like $750 a day or $500 a day, and have or offer a flat fee for the consultancy that would end up paying me a net of about $750 a day. If they were one of these typical poor, struggling, you know, filmmakers with no big guarantees, you know, I might, because I was really eager to do it, I would probably charge a fairly low, you know, rate that would come out to maybe, you know, $200 or $300 a day. Something like that. It's going to depend on how well-funded they are. But I want to spend most of this phone call talking about marketing the parenting thing, the emotional intelligence thing. I am completely convinced that that is a wonderful niche that is under-tapped. Mm-hmm. So many families are pulling their hair out with their kids. They don't need a shrink. They need somebody to teach their kid how to be a better family member, a better class member. And all that is about emotional intelligence. It is teaching that sophistication both to the kid and to the family. I think that there is an unlimited demand. And if you market it just the way I just said, in terms of the message, is you don't want to shrink. Your kid is not screwed up. You're not screwed up. Not that, you know, everybody who sees shrinks are screwed up, but I don't want to get all the hate mail that's going to no doubt come. But if you are just looking for somebody to be a coach, to coach your child, to be to rise to the next level of emotional intelligence in the way in which they interact with peers, with family members, you can help them. And the product that you would be giving them would be on site. You would go and you would observe the kid in, to use the technical term, in situ, in the school at recess, in the class, at home, with family members, with friends after school. You would, that would help you to get a really good sense of what the kid's problem is, and the family members may be the problem as much. And at that point, you can then develop a prescription, say, I'm going to work with your kid and with maybe the teacher and maybe with you, the parent or the sibling, to improve the emotional intelligence and overall emotional well-being and connectedness of all concerned. That is a big enough kind of a project that you could charge a reasonable amount of money and I think could make an enormous difference. And to market it, I would go and be giving free talks to PTAs at church youth group where they would invite the parents. I would, if I'm a writer, I would blog or write articles for the local publications that would be read by parents in fairly affluent enough communities they could afford to. What do you like and not like about that vision?
I love it all. I mean, I'm doing some of it. I like the idea of making it more national or more global even.
Go small. Do it small.
Okay.
If you can be successful, you can always grow it. What counts is quality. Mm-hmm. Do it slowly with great integrity and quality first. And then if you find yourself with more business than you know what to do with, hire and train somebody who is magnificent also to do what you're doing. The Bay Area has millions of people and thousands of parents who are struggling in this very thing. You don't need to go national. It's going to make you go crazy. Then you become a bureaucrat. You become running a business. You're not a business owner. A business runner. You're not like some MBA type. I can feel it, obviously. You're a puppeteer.
I'm not. Yes.
So keep it small. Keep it simple. You know, I have so many times asked, why have Marty Nemco, have you not created a national chain of Nemco certified career counselors? Because I'm not a business person. I don't like business. I can do it. But I keep it small. I see almost, you know, most of the clients just myself. I refer out a percentage, but really small enables me to keep the quality control up. And I spend most of my life as a career counselor, not a business person, which is the way I want to spend my life. Does that make sense?
Absolutely.
All right.
Absolutely.
Elise, all our lines are lighted up, so hopefully I'm going to thank you for the call. And certainly feel free to call back some other time when you have made some progress and are ready for some more advanced guidance. Make sense? She's gone. All right, back to the phones. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemco. It is your turn on the air. What's your situation?
Are you talking to me?
I am.
Hey, hi. First of all, I appreciate your advice on the previous caller about what to ask for in terms of money. I'm self-employed as a party planner, mm-hmm. and it's tough figuring out that if you charge too little, then you're not going to get the job of respect. I actually kind of have a reverse question having to do with hiring people. Mm-hmm. Half of my people are seasoned professionals, but the other half are part-time. And I was kind of curious if there was anything that you really were looking for people that are pretty much, you know, your callers who are kind of confused about what they're going to do next. Is there anything that you would suggest in terms of presenting myself to them, in terms of letting them know that it's okay not to say you're a dedicated industry professional?
Yes.
Really, we're trying to attract all sorts of different people, and waiting out the pure BS is kind of hard. So do you have any thoughts on that at all?
Of course I do. Now, I want to make sure I understand. The kind of part-timers you're, what do you want them to, what are you going to be hiring them to do, or what are you hiring them to do?
Being dazzling personalities, typically. A combination between physical labor and actual service stuff. So it's mostly catering. So it's really a lot of people just have these skills naturally. It's a matter of just telling them the actual form in which we're working on that particular day.
So am I correct that what they're doing is they're being waiters, bartenders, servers, unloading stuff from the van?
On a lower level, but very often someone will come to me with an MBA or in another industry, and they will try to curtail their resume or their question to make me think that they're perfect for me.
Yeah, I understand. No, I'm asking, I want to know the job. What when you're hiring them, you're hiring them to precisely do what? I know that you'd like them to have a scintillating personality, but what is it they're actually going to be doing?
Typically, it's dealing with the public and serving.
Okay, so they're on site. They are the servers, basically, on the catering gig. Is that correct?
Absolutely.
Okay, great. So it's two things you've got to do. One is in the way in which you word the job ad. Let's say you're placing an ad on Craigslist.
Right.
Here's how I would word it. Wanted, smart, fun, people-oriented people to join the team of servers and cleanup people at catering high-end events or whatever events they are. That's it. No experience required. Personality is. That's it. So it creates conveys the right image, so they're not going to try to BS you in any way. So
That's what I'm trying to eliminate.
Right. So it's the way, that informal way in which I just worded the job description, which is key. And then the other thing is, when you interview, interviews are so BS prone. People will always, because especially in this terrible job market, they're going to do whatever they can to get the job. So
that's my biggest dilemma, right? Is if people say they want to work ineffectively, they simply don't. So really finding out the ones that are willing to do this until they go to their next step and being okay to let us know there is a next step. We're kind of part of the solution, not part of the problem.
So here what you do. It's very simple. When you get to the interview, again, you're going to be informal. You say, hey, this is really what the gig is like. This is what you're going to be asked to do. If you're going to hate this and it's going to be boring and you can't stand the thought of this, please tell me it's not a good fit. Notice my language. It's very informal. It's not like I'm a formal job seeker interviewer. If I use formal job seeker language and tone, it makes them want to BS. If instead I'm really informal and human and just being a straight shooter, that, number one, is going to give me some guides. Number two, I put them through a simulation. Simulation is the most important word in job interviews. I say, okay, so here is this tray of hors d'oeuvres, right? And make believe you're going to be trying to distribute these hors d'oeuvres to the three of us who are getting interviewed. How would you do it?
Role playing. No, I never thought of that before.
Well, that's good. That's why you're calling. And then the third thing is, you do, after you've got somebody you're thinking about hiring, ask for some references, and then when you call the references, what you do is you continue with that informal approach. Let's say I'm calling this reference. I say, I'm thinking of hiring Jane Jones to be a server at my little catering place. We serve, prawn in mango, kind of yuppie food, prawns in a mango salsa, all that stuff.
And hey, that's my menu. Careful.
Exactly. Right. It's amazing. You can charge $2 a shrimp. It's incredible, but that's another story.
More, but go on.
You're kidding. What do you charge for a prawn with mango salsa?
$2.75.
$2.75 per prawn. That is a pricey prawn. Okay. Here, but they must be
really good, and it's huge. What can I say?
They must be. Are they under? Let's be straight. Are they under five size prawns, dude?
No. They're the gigantic 1620s. Actually, cost wise, the client is actually doing pretty well at $2.75 shrimps. But thank you. I'd also encourage anybody who wants to be self employed to do it. But the stress of knowing where your next job comes from equals the stress of not knowing if you're going to be fired. It's just a different type of stress.
Yeah,
so
you got to be willing to market. You got to be willing to market. So my point is, when you call those references, got to be informal. Say, I'm hiring this guy to be handing out hors d'oeuvres, basically. He's got to have an amazing personality, and he's got to be or she's got to be totally reliable.
Right.
Honestly, it's a very important position I'm hiring for. Can you honestly tell me this person is awesome? What I also do is, you can leave voicemail saying that. If they don't call back, I'd say, only call me back if you think the person's awesome. That way, if they don't call back, then you, without them having a bad mouth the candidate, you get the picture.
Which is illegal anyway. Well, I really appreciate it. Thank you very much.
Okay, you're welcome. By the way, it is not illegal to say something bad about an employee. That is incorrect.
I thought the only thing that you could say was the last wage.
That is incorrect. Very often the lawyers will tell companies that the policy should be to only give name, rank, and serial number because they don't want to get sued. But it's not a law. And you realize why the lawyers do that. Because if, let's say, I give a reference for Jane Jones, and I say she's great, and then she goes and robs your whole joint, you could sue me for giving, and possibly sue me for giving a reference that was invalid, especially if you found out later that in fact she had been dishonest with me. Or if I give a terrible reference for Jane Jones and she finds out about it, she could sue me and say that was unfair and et cetera. So that's why a lot of companies have policies that say, no, don't say anything about the person, just name, rank, and serial number. But it's not a law.
Oh, so the act itself is not a law. Okay.
All right. Okay.
Thank you. Have a great day.
By the way, for those of you who are interested, this under five business, 16 to 20, you know what that means? It's under five per pound. So when you see those, you very often you'll see shrimp. 70 to 100 is the small little shrimp. That means that there are 70 to 100 that make up a pound. That means that they're the smallest. Under 5 means it's less than 5 per pound. You never know what you're going to learn on Work with Marty Nemco. God. Okay, back to the phones. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemco. It is your turn on the air. How can
Hi,
I help?
Thank you so much for taking my call.
Sure.
I really appreciate your program, and especially liked was inspired to learn more about Thomas Farm today.
It was fun. He's a great guy, and I honestly, I swear in my life, this is not like radio hype at all. I have been to his stand at the Temescal Market. The stuff is delicious, fresh, completely different than the crap you get at Safeway. Period. Oh. I can't believe how good those tomatoes were. And again, the price, you know, a bouquet of flowers, again, organically grown like dahlias, $5 for a big bunch. You know, not expensive, nice, and it's really kind of a good vibe there. I will admit, however, that I went to the Temescal, farmer's market with my doggie, and some Nazi there said no dogs allowed. It was just for no reason. There's, you know, talk about a ridiculous regulation. It wasn't, you know, he was on a leash. He's a small little dog. Stupid regulations. But I digress. How can I help you?
Okay, well, actually, I was really interested in his farm because I want to branch into, I've been working in hospitality for about 10 years, and I've also been working at flower stands, and I'll work right now as a floral designer. Hmm. And my main interest in flowers is organic and sustainable flowers.
Right.
And so I wanted to, I work part-time in a shop right now, but I'm wanting to have kind of a side business in event design and floral design. And I wanted to talk with you about whether you think the hospitality market has really tanked. I was laid off in 2009.
And hospitality really is normally shorthand for hotels. You're talking about working in hotels?
No. I mean, hospitality, like in event, I was doing event design, event planning.
Okay.
For different companies and then caterers, things like that. So, right now I work for a restaurant and I'm working in the floral department. So, I wanted to have kind of not have a shop because I know there's a lot of overhead for having your
I'm going to interrupt you. The picture. Let me tell you what I would do. You know, I cannot guarantee that it's viable or not, but I can certainly tell you a low-key, low-expense way to find out. Not low-key. Low-expense way to find out how viable it would be. If I were trying to make organic, sustainable flower arrangements,
yeah.
I would contact, I would make a list of 100. 100 is a nice magic number of the leading ongoing buyers of such things, that is, wedding planners, especially in Berkeley and Santa Cruz and in San Francisco, you know, be the leading wedding planners who seem to have let's just call it an alternative feel to them in the way in which their ads are listed and the way their websites are described. I would be looking at venues, especially venues that, like my daughter, is very much in the environmentalist space. So she had her wedding at the Audubon Center in near Washington, D.C., in a forest. So it would be venues that have that kind of sensibilities, wedding planners that had that kind of sensibilities. Universities are always in the are very committed to such matters, also large, you know, solar and wind and those kind of companies, if they're having events, I'd make a list of 100 of the most likely targets for such business. And then I would call all, maybe at least 30 at random, and ask them, no BS, how interested would they be in somebody who provided organic, sustainable flower arrangements for your company events, for your wedding, for that you'd tout at weddings, etc. And that would help me, for very minimal cost, do the kind of market research that would let me know if this is viable or not. Does that make sense?
That does. It really does.
Okay. Sure. Thanks a lot for the call. Back to the phones. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemco. It's your turn on the air. How can I help you?
Hi. Thanks very much for taking the call. Few things. One, I do was at the Longview Farmers Market, and they do have those dried tomatoes there. So
yeah,
they're in season.
Oh, great! Now I'm saying you cut out. What farmers market did you go to?
The Mountain View Farmers Market.
Valley. I still didn't get the phrase. What is it? What farm? Mountain View. Okay, great. Yeah, it was just your phone was cutting out. So Mountain View Farmer, good to know. There is nothing like a dry farmed early girl tomato. period. Not the other, you know, the other heirloom tomatoes are not. I have been eating Brandywine tomatoes and all these other heirlooms, German, whatever it's called, stripey, all the rest of them. They don't taste that great, but Early Girl, because it's a relatively small tomato, and when it's dry farmed, all the water is kind of leached out, and it is unbelievably good. I digress. Continue. How can I help?
Well, the other thing is simply I'm thinking about the solar power field, especially this sort of like solar city
right.
Business model.
Yeah.
And, you know, besides selling this service, I'm trying to think of how else might I get into this.
I get in trouble because my listeners, so many of my listeners are such true believers in solar. I've said it before, and I must, in ethics, say it again. I've had the privilege of, my PhD is in research and evaluation. I know a lot about statistics. I've also had the privilege, I was invited to Bill Clinton's what they call Renaissance Weekend, where some of the most brilliant people in the world are. And I've spoken with world-class physicists, and there is a fair degree of unanimity that solar is overrated. So not only is it oversaturated, but there is tremendous physics limitations on how much solar is going to be the answer. I've been saying this for 3 years on the radio and get hate mail all the time when I say it, but the reality is that I've been proven right. The solar index, which is the market basket of solar stocks, was at its peak, not surprisingly, when President Obama took office in late 2007. It is down 93% from there. It was 1,800 at its peak. It is now 148. It is down 93%. And what that means is, if those companies are worth less and less, it means there are less and less jobs. And the stock market is a forward measure. It projects forward what they project the future is. So at the risk of getting yet more hate mail, I must discourage, if I am to have any ethics at all, I must discourage anybody from going into the solar field. It's oversold from both a physics standpoint, because remember, that solar energy, those collectors are expensive and tend to wear out because they're subject to so much sun. The storage issue is a problem. The transmission issue, there's tremendous heat loss in transmission because to go from where those solar farms are located in Nevada to far distances there's tremendous heat loss. And yes, putting a solar heater on your house may, in the long run, save you money, but it's not a major player in the energy solution, and the real experts are willing to admit that. So I've got to be, if I'm to be honest, at least one guy's opinion who's not ignorant on the subject, I'm very pessimistic about the world of solar, period.
Oh, rooftop solar, not on your radar as a thing.
There's too much, as I said. You know, it can be a bit player, but it is so oversold at this point. There is a solar distributor under every rock, and it has become, believe it or not, a relatively mature industry, so that big mega corporations like Solar City, which is not some little small solar, it is a highly profitable stock exchange listed corporation with a big expensive infrastructure and high profit margins. It's in my opinion, and no host can be, talk show host can be definitive. You know, it is a reasonable statement, a reasonably derived statement to say you're as late to getting into the solar on rooftop game as a cigar store owner who'd like to open a cigar store now would try to open a cigar. That's the end. That's all the time we've got. The show is over. So I thank you very much for the call. That is Work with Marty Namco for this week. My thanks to my board operator, Debbie Kennedy, of course, to all of you for listening and calling in. Please join me again next Sunday at 11. I will I'm not going to do a 3-minute career makeovers. I am going to talk with 2-time Pulitzer winner, 2-time National Book Award winner, the preeminent biographer living in America, David McCulloch. He's written biographies of everyone from artists to doctors, bridge builders to presidents. David McCulloch is going to chat with me about lessons about career that apply to us all. Plus, my wife, Barbara Nemco, and I are going to discuss the book, 50 Jewish Women Who Changed the World. Until next Sunday, this is Marty Nemco reminding you that we find comfort among those who agree with us, growth among those who don't.
More than 500 of Marty Nemco's published articles and chapters from his book, Cool Careers for Dummies, are free on his website. From there, you also can email him if you'd like coaching on your career or want to comment on this program. His site, martynemco.com. That's martynemko.com. And you can join Marty again next Sunday morning at 11 for Work with Marty Nemco right here on 91.7 KALW San Francisco.